Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Is Earth one of many habitable planets in the universe? Or are we, Earthlings, the product of a lucky fluke? Our guest this hour says it's more likely the latter, thanks to our planet's unusually stable climate and early development of life. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll talk with the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional, and what that means for life in the universe, and wonder if you agree with our guest that life on Earth is a lucky accident. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. David Waltham is an astrobiologist and geophysicist in the Department of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway College at the University of London. He is the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what makes the Earth so lucky? We'll talk about it all hour, but generally, why are we such a lucky planet?
Because we're here. Some people might even dispute whether I'm using the right word lucky there. Some people say that's unlucky. But the basic idea is that it takes an extraordinary dose of luck to have the conditions necessary for life and for those conditions to remain for billions of years. And without that, intelligent life won't arise. It's lucky in the sense that it's not going to happen very often.
And it's not likely that it's happened anywhere in our universe besides Earth.
I wouldn't put it quite that way. The universe is absolutely immense. The numbers of planets in the visible universe, it's about the same as the number of grains of sand in a cubic mile. You know, it's an awful lot of planets. So I'm not saying it's never happened anywhere else. What I'm saying is that given that number of planets, it doesn't have to happen very often to explain our existence. You know, essentially, what I'm saying is perhaps it only happens once in a billion galaxies, let's say. But even then, there would still be hundreds or thousands of such places in the universe. It's just the nearest one will be so far away that we've got no chance of ever contacting them.
Yeah, so maybe we aren't alone, but our neighbors are so far away, we'll never know.
Yeah, the way I put it is that we're effectively alone.
Okay.
Oh, yes. I wouldn't say we're alone. I think we're just effectively alone. The nearest contactable civilization could be literally beyond the cosmic horizon. They could be that far away.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the factors. So, what do we know about how life originated on Earth?
Surprisingly little, actually. It's still a major area of scientific controversy. There are lots of theories around, but nobody really has a good conclusive idea of the sequence of events that gave rise to life on the Earth. All we really know for sure is that within a few hundred million years of liquid water first appearing on the Earth, there are signs of life. So it does seem to have happened relatively quickly, if you can call a few hundred million years quick. How it happened and where it happened, there are lots and lots of different guesses and lots of different theories, and no one's really been able to establish that yet.
So what factors make the Earth habitable?
I think the key thing, and the thing that everyone, of course, goes for first, is liquid water. It's certainly the case that, as far as Earth life is concerned, there is no life without liquid water. But on Earth, everywhere where there is liquid water, you find life. So there's a very direct link between the two there. And that's essentially the argument that I'm making. It's not that easy to have liquid water on a planet continuously for billions of years. It requires a large dose of luck for that to happen.
Yeah.
Other than that, what you need is some energy, some source of energy for the life to use for growth and reproduction. production and so on, and nutrients. You need something to build that life from. So if you've got all those ingredients, perhaps you're in with a chance of it starting. But as I said, we really don't know the circumstances under which life started. And for all we know, that in itself was an amazing fluke.
So why is it possible that life might not have arisen on Earth?
I'm not quite sure I follow that question. It did arise on Earth.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the climate that we have.
Yes. Okay. One of the big problems that there is for a planet to remain habitable for billions of years is that as stars age, they get more luminous. They kick out more heat. And the sun actually kicks out about 10% more heat every billion years. Now, the remarkable thing about the Earth, and something that we still haven't properly explained, is that despite the fact that the sun is now 40% warmer than it was when the Earth was young, throughout that time we've had liquid water. And if anything, the climate's got a little bit cooler over time. You know, the data is quite contentious itself, but what data we do have tends to suggest that the early Earth was warmer than it is now, whereas it should have been colder because there should have been a lot less heat coming out of the sun. So what's happened there is that through time, the composition of the atmosphere has changed massively. I mean, there was no oxygen for the first 2 billion years or so, but what there was a lot more greenhouse gas. So as a consequence of that, the Earth was able to be warmer even though the sun was a lot fainter then.
Yeah. What the climate has sustained us for all this time. Any thoughts as to whether with climate change whether it still will?
Yes, that's actually a part of the what comes out from this sort of as a spin-off, if you like, is the suggestion that what I'm actually suggesting in the book is that the reason that our climate has been stable for that length of time is not because they're stabilizing mechanisms, but actually literally because of good luck. Effectively, what I'm saying is that there are so many planets in the universe that occasionally you're going to find a planet that just gets lucky, where everything just works out, everything happens at the right time in the right way, and not because there's any real controlling mechanism. Now, if that argument is correct, obviously a spin-off from that is that we don't have climate stabilizing mechanisms, and we may find out the hard way that, Earth's climate is not naturally stable.
Well, is it within our means to control this?
Well, if things are as bad as I'm suggesting there, I mean, that sounds like a very pessimistic point of view, but if things are that bad, we're going to have to take control. There's nothing else that we'll be able to do it. And there are things we can do. We know what the factors are that control climate. It's essentially how much heat you get from the sun, how much of it gets reflected back into space, and what the strength of the greenhouse gases are. So, we're getting a little bit off topic here, but that doesn't matter. But essentially, yes, if we had to, I'm sure we could. But it would require a major political reorganization. The problems will be social ones and political ones, not technical ones. You know, we can't even agree amongst ourselves what we do about the carbon dioxide that we're pumping into the atmosphere now. And what you're talking about there is a much, much more serious and much bigger effort than merely trying to curb slightly how much carbon dioxide we produce. So, the problems will be enormous. But we're quite good at solving problems as human beings, so I would be optimistic if we had to do it that we could.
We are talking with David Waltham. He is the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's talk a little bit about get back to our subject as to what makes the Earth so lucky. Talk some about you write about the imaginary sister planet for Earth called Nemesis, with a completely different outcome than what happened to Earth. How might Earth's development have gone differently?
Yeah, the key difference between Earth and my imagined planet, Nemesis, I mean, essentially their life stories were virtually identical until about 60 million years ago or so. And at that point, what I imagine happening to that planet is that its axis has become unstable. Now, the reason for that instability is all to do with the moon and the fact that as the Earth and moon have aged, the moon's been slowly moving away from the Earth, and eventually it gets so far away that the tidal forces it's exerting on our axis have the effect of making our axis unstable. It's a quite complicated process. It's all to do with resonance between the way our axis wobbles and the way the orbits of the planets are wobbling. But on the real Earth, the Earth we've actually got, we're very fortunate. This problem of our axis becoming unstable won't happen for another 1.5 billion years. But if you do the math for it, it's quite surprising. What you find is you've only got to make the moon very slightly bigger. And instead of that happening in 1.5 billion years' time, it would be happening now, or perhaps 60 million years ago. So Nemesis, what I imagined for Nemesis was that it had a moon that was just 20 kilometers bigger than ours. And that was enough for the extra tidal drag that produces to slow the Earth's rotation a little bit more quickly and to make the moon recede a little bit more quickly. And that was enough for its axis to become unstable. Now, as soon as that axis becomes unstable, the climate is horrendous. We're talking about the axis perhaps swinging through 50 degrees or more within a million years. So this is a massive climate change compared to anything that the Earth has ever seen, and would be very catastrophic and very damaging to any complex life on such a world. So, on Nemesis, by the time it gets to being the same age as our Earth is now, there's very little life left on it.
Well, what about our real neighbor, Mars? I mean, there has been, we're trying to find life on Mars and whether life ever existed on Mars. So, what was so different about Mars than the Earth?
Yeah, that's the question lots of people would like to be able to answer. One thing we do know is that when Mars was young, it did have quite a lot of liquid water on its surface. There's lots of evidence for that in terms of large runoff channels and geographical features like that. So that water's gone somewhere. It's quite possibly just disappeared beneath the subsurface and is now all frozen as ice. So Mars is actually a very good example of a planet that started off with a climate that was suitable for life, but no longer has one. Now, having said that, I actually think there might be some life on Mars, a little bit, not very much. If there was very much life there, we would know about it. It would be very, very obvious. But there might be, deep beneath the subsurface, a few primitive microbes hanging on, clinging on to life, as it were. But even if that's the case, it's quite likely that that life is, in fact, transplanted Earth life, because Earth and Mars are not isolated from each other. They exchange rocks through meteorite impacts. So, any life that arose on Earth could have got transported across to Mars, or vice versa. Some people actually think that life might have started on Mars and got transported to the Earth when the Earth was still very young. So I think the chances of finding something very limited on Mars are actually quite good. But that's all we're going to find. We're certainly not going to find, big green monsters with two heads and digging canals and that kind of thing. That idea of Mars life has now completely gone.
We are talking with David Waltham, author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. And he says that we're lucky. We're here. And the chances of complex life outside of Earth, we are effectively alone, he says, that life would be so far beyond the edge of the visible universe that we will never be able to communicate with it. We are finding out what makes Earth so special and welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about whether we are alone in the universe. Is there life on other planets? And why our guest says that certainly there might be some life on other planets, but a complex life is probably far, far away, so we are effectively alone. And we're wondering, and we're talking about why that is, and wondering what questions you have. Our guest is the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And our first caller is Michael in Milwaukee. Hello, Michael.
Hello, yes. Thank you for taking my call. my question, given that science holds to the belief that life has formed without the benefit of conscious intention, I'm wondering about the nature of DNA, and is there something essential about the physics of the universe itself, or the relationship between the sun's energy and matter, that would give rise to this kind of like consecutive linking of amino acids or the building of proteins and then memory and repetition and the formulation of DNA. Like, how unique is that? And what does that inform something about the nature of the universe itself? Because that would seem to make it possible for there to be life in other places. So that's sort of the essence of my question.
David Waltham.
Okay, yeah, that's a really complicated set of questions there, actually. The whole basis of Earth life, based on DNA and on proteins, is a very, very complex mechanism. And I don't think any astrobiologists think that life started that way on Earth. It's far more likely that the early life on Earth was something much, much simpler than that, and that these complex mechanisms have evolved over time, you know, perhaps over tens or hundreds of millions of years. Having said that, amino acids, which make proteins, are quite easy to make, and they seem to be quite common. What's difficult is actually to make the very specialist and limited sets that life uses. I mean, life uses, I think it's 20 amino acids, if I remember rightly, but there are actually hundreds of them. So, you know, any experiments that we've done to try and make amino acids in the laboratory have actually ended up making a complete gunk, a horrible mess that's nothing like life. It really hasn't got the structure and organization of life at all. Moving a bit away from amino acids and from DNA, some people certainly think that there's something about the nature of the universe that encourages complexity. So it encourages complex structures to form. And maybe that's something that's built into the laws of the universe somehow. I'd have to say that it's an interesting philosophical idea, but I don't know of any really good evidence for it. It may turn out to be true. It may turn out to be completely wrong. I guess I don't have a strong view on whether that's right or wrong, to be honest. Most of what I'm talking about in my book is actually about complex life. So once life's got started and then builds up into multicelled organisms, and those multicelled organisms, you know, eventually become, you know, intelligent organisms like us, that's the end of things that I'm more talking about. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I've got many colleagues who would talk to you for hours on the complexities of biochemistry, but it's not really my area, I have to say.
Might not be your area, but respond to a similar comment from Tom, who emailed this. I think this is a part of what Michael was getting at. What are the mathematical odds of a livable Earth coming to be? Seems to me a strong argument for a designer, which he says has been the belief of many scientists for centuries.
Yes, I guess I should be honest and say it's not my belief. I wouldn't start from that kind of an argument. Really, it is a numbers game. What I would say, I would look at it the other way around, and again, come back to how many planets that there are in the universe, and the fact that in modern cosmology, the actual universe is probably vastly larger even than the bit we can see. So the numbers of planets you get to are, you know, quite literally astronomical. So really, the way I look at things is almost to turn that thing on its head and say, we only need intelligent life to be that likely, as in, you know, once in the entire universe. That's all we need to explain our existence. And that's a very, very small number. Whether it's a small or what you'd have to work out in order to see, well, I guess what your caller's getting at is Fred Hoyle's question about a whirlwind going through a pile of junk and assembling a jumbo jet by accident. What's the chances of that happening? Now, that kind of thing is not going to happen even in a universe as large as ours. The chances of that are way, way beyond even what we can do with the numbers of planets that are available. So if you want to, as it were, construct a living planet from scratch in one go, no, it's not going to happen. But, of course, that's not the way the Earth has developed. It is a more gradual process. So we need something a little bit less unlikely than that to happen to start with, and then a sequence of, in my view, very unlikely things, but not as unlikely as your emailer is getting at.
Yeah. You do say that life rose relatively early in Earth's geological history. First, what do you mean by this?
Well, compared to how old the Earth is, we know the Earth's 4.5 billion years old. And for the vast majority of that time, there's been life on the Earth. So life started early here in the sense that, you know, compared to the age of the Earth, you know, the Earth wasn't very old at that time. But as I said earlier, it's still quite a long time. We're probably talking about a few hundred million years between the origin of the Earth and the first living organisms. So that's still quite a long time, to be honest.
And what does that, I don't know, early development, why is that important to the development of intelligent, complex life?
Yeah, one of the things that worries me about what other astrobiologists say, it's quite common for astrobiologists to argue that actually life must be quite easy, that it must happen on many, many planets because it started early on the Earth. And they're taking the early start for life on the Earth as being evidence that life is something that happens quite easily. I think that argument is completely wrong. And the reason it's wrong is that because it takes billions of years to go from simple organisms through to intelligent organisms like us, there's what's called an observational bias. Essentially, intelligent observers can only ever see a planet where life started early, because if life starts late, it will never develop far enough for intelligent observers to arise. So it's a slightly topsy-turvy argument. It's a slightly back-to-front argument almost, but I think it's a good argument. And to me, that destroys the argument that life is an easy trick. I don't think life is an easy trek, and I don't think we've got any evidence at all that life is something that happens very easily on lots of planets.
Let's go to Claude in Cudahy. Hi, Claude.
Hi. You were just answering some of my thoughts. Carl Sagan says that life with a capital L, seems to be a relatively robust accident. And I'm wondering how your theory differs from his. Maybe he just didn't take as many parameters into account. But also, I was thinking, I used to teach science. There's a consideration in science that says there are no singularities, meaning that if something has happened once, it'll happen often. How do you reconcile Carl Sagan's thoughts and yours?
Yeah, that's an excellent couple of questions. Much as I hate to disagree with Carl Sagan, because I mean, he is a personal hero. He's an absolutely brilliant man. Many of the arguments that I'm actually using originated from him. Sorry to digress slightly, but what I was talking about earlier about the fact that the early sun was too faint to make the Earth warm enough, that's called the faint young sun paradox, and that was actually Carl Sagan who dreamt that one up. So yeah, I hate to disagree with him, but essentially, again, it's an observational bias. It isn't possible for us to look back and see a history of life where life didn't continue to survive, didn't always survive, because if life had got wiped out, we wouldn't be here. So just by the nature of the observation that we're making, you know, we have to see that continuity to life. So again, I don't think the fact that we see a continuity to life, it can be taken as evidence that life is robust. Because you know, if life is wiped out on, let's say, 99% of all planets where it first arises, it gets wiped out by something, we must be on that 1% that got lucky. So that's the problem I have with that argument. The singularity argument is another interesting one, and I think it's really the same kind of problem. The trouble is that at the moment, it is a singular event because we don't know of life anywhere else. And yeah, I should actually say at this point that obviously I'm very well aware that there's enormous danger in extrapolating from one case, which is what I'm doing. We've got the case of the Earth, that's all we know about, and we have to extrapolate from there, and that's going to be a very dangerous thing to do. But it's all we've got. Now, because we only do have the one, I think that idea that if things happen once, they'll happen lots of times is a very useful working principle within science. It's a useful tool, but I don't think we should turn it into a religious principle that has to be always correct. I think in the case of life and continuous life for billions of years, as we've seen on the Earth, perhaps that useful working principle just doesn't work anymore.
Thank you, Claude. Another caller who couldn't stay on the line said that he thinks life could be more prevalent because it doesn't all have to look like us, that it could be sulfur-based or iron-based instead of carbon-based, which is what we are. What about that?
Yeah, very common argument. I very often come across that one. And of course, he's right. I mean, I can't say that he's wrong because we haven't got the evidence. What we have to do is we have to start from what we know, and what we know is Earth life. Now, the argument I would make is there's no reason to think that we're not typical in the sense of where there is some life, particularly complex life. We're probably typical of complex life in the universe, even though that complex life is very rare. It would be quite surprising if we were an unusual form of complex life. That would be even more surprising than that we're the only form of complex life. So we have to start from that assumption, is all I'm saying. There is nowhere else to go. So we start with the assumption that life in the rest of the universe is going to be water-based and carbon-based and so on. And I think we can make a good argument that if there is life out there, quite a lot of it will be water-based and carbon-based because we are, and there's no reason to think that we're odd or peculiar in that way. Personally, I would find it very surprising if there's lots of different ways to make life. Life, to me, is such an amazing miracle that I'm amazed there's even one way to do it. So my personal view is that it's unlikely that there are lots of different ways of doing it, but I could well be wrong. Again, I'm extrapolating from one case, one example, and that is inherently dangerous.
We're talking with David Waltham. He is an astrobiologist and geophysicist in the Department of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway College at the University of London. He is the author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. We welcome your thoughts, your questions. Do you agree with our guest that life on Earth is a lucky accident? What do you think about the chance of there being life on other planets? What questions do you have about the development of life on Earth? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Edwin in Four Corners is with us. Hi, Edwin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I find it fascinating that the Earth is unique and resilient, and I know that, science's charge is to know. We start at what we know, as your guest said. But what I'm hearing is that when I was a kid growing up watching Carl Sagan, there was his theory, billions and billions of other intelligent life throughout the universe, and now we find out through your guest that we apparently are the only ones, and then earlier, the inability to create amino acids in the cell seems to throw Darwin's theory that the cell emerged from a swamp out the window. And I guess what I'm saying is, I know that we live in an age of science now when the mere mention of God is verboten, but as a believer, terms like fluke and luck and we don't know, perhaps the less bullying and more respectful term for fluke and luck would be miracle.
Well, you used that one too. But what's your response to that, David?
Yeah, I'm not sure I disagree with anything that's just been said. I don't actually object to use of the word God at all. I think I use it 3 or 4 times in the book. My take on it would be that what I would hope is that someone could read my book if they're a person of faith, but they could also read it if they were not. I think the scientific approach is to come up with rational, non-supernatural explanations for things whenever possible. And we should take that process as far as we can. And we should all agree that that's a good way to go. But yeah, at the end, I don't think I say anything in the book that someone who is religious could object to. At least I hope not. I've certainly tried to avoid doing that. And my own view on the matter is that I think it's very difficult. I think that there are things about the universe that I find deeply mysterious. So I can easily understand why someone might want to go down a religious explanation for such things. I don't do that myself. I avoid doing that because I think once you start doing that, you actually stop looking for answers. I think that's the problem with going down that route. But having said that, that doesn't mean to say that going down that route is wrong. It could well be the right answer. It's just not a path I'm personally taking.
We are talking with David Waltham, author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Is Earth one of many habitable planets in the universe, or are we alone, the product of a lucky fluke? We are talking with a guest who says that we are indeed lucky, in that while there might be a complex life out there on other planets, it's pretty far away, so we're essentially alone. We're talking about why we are lucky to be alive, why we are a lucky planet, and welcoming your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Guest says that thanks to our planet's unusually stable climate and early development of life, that's one of the reasons why. Couple of the reasons why we are a lucky planet. At one point in the book, David Waltham, you talk about how scientists theorize that life on Earth created chemical processes that helped sustain life on Earth, the Gaia theory. How much truth do you see in this, and would it help to make life possible elsewhere?
Yeah, I think Gaia is almost the alternative to what I'm putting forward, or perhaps the other way around. The Gaia theory has been about since the 1970s, and essentially what it says is that a complex biosphere stabilizes the environment, which is a fascinating idea. But the core idea in my book is actually the exact opposite of that. What I'm actually saying is that a stable environment was a necessary precondition for a complex biosphere. So I think Gaia is actually confused cause and effect. It's not that the complex biosphere gives stability, it's that stability was necessary for the complex biosphere. So very much the book is a counter-argument to the Gaia hypothesis, and I would very much see it in that light. So, if you've got any Gaia enthusiasts, I'd like to hear from them.
Well, what about, talk about Daisy World and how it relates to how Earth actually has been shaped by the life forms on it.
Yeah, Daisy World's a sort of a toy world. It's not meant to be anything very realistic. It's just an illustration of how life might control the environment. And the idea of Daisy World is that there are only two species on that world. There's black daisies and white daisies. And as that world's sun is heating up and the world gets hotter, the white daisies reflect the heat away, and because they reflect the heat away, they stay cooler, so they thrive. And so the white daisies tend to spread and cover across that planet, making the whole planet whiter and therefore the whole planet cooler. So it's a very simple model that can show a way in which living organisms might control the environment. The problem I have with it is that when you actually look at real organisms, they don't behave that way at all. And it's quite easy to come up with real organisms that do the exact opposite. One good example is that at the end of the last ice age, the forests in the north, north of Russia and the north of America, spread north, and as they did so, they actually started to reflect more heat rather than less. So they were actually having the exact opposite effect. So almost like an anti-Daisy World effect. Mm-hmm. And there are many other cases too. So that's the problem I have with Gaia, is it's not obvious why the organisms should behave in that way. It's quite easy to make up planets which do have the right kind of behavior. So we can invent worlds that are environmentally stable because of the organisms on them. But real organisms don't seem to want to cooperate. So I find it an unconvincing argument. But it's an area of lots of research. Lots of people are working in this area and trying to come up with more convincing models. So perhaps they will come up with something that's more convincing. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, do you have any questions or any challenges for our guest, David Waltham? We have an open line for you to talk about life on Earth and how it happened and why our guest says we are so lucky that the Earth is exceptional and that it's a very lucky thing that we are here right now. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest says that maybe there's life elsewhere, maybe probably life elsewhere, but if so, it's on the edge of the visible universe and we will never be able to communicate with it, so we are effectively alone. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, David Waltham, Stephen Hawking famously said that even if life does exist elsewhere, we shouldn't be looking for it because it's almost certainly hostile. So what do you think about that?
Oh, yes. I think it's almost impossible to tell, to be honest. I mean, given the problems with extrapolating from Earth life in terms of just the chemistry, as one of your earlier talkers, callers mentioned, to actually start to hypothesize about alien psychology and so on is very, very difficult. So I think we're really getting into the realms of just complete imagination there. I have no idea at all if any alien life from another planet would be hostile or not. I guess it's possible, and other people have made arguments that if such life survived long enough to get out into interstellar space, they must have sorted out their aggression and therefore be nice and peaceful. That seems a bit like wishful thinking to me too, to be honest. So, I don't know. I might be inclined to agree with Stephen Hawking on this one. Perhaps there is a tendency for life to often be attempt to dominate and to take over. That may be true. But it is very much wild speculation, in my view. We just don't know what alien psychology would be like.
Yeah. What about besides alien psychology, what about the thought that we don't really need to be looking for it?
Well, there's some people have actually suggested to me that I'm basically arguing against the spending money on looking for planets and life on other planets and so on. And that actually horrifies me because I think this is a fascinating topic. Funnily enough, I'd love to be wrong about all this. I started out looking at these things because I was interested in the idea of life on other planets. In a sense, I'm disappointed that the conclusion I've come to is that I think it's going to be very, very rare. But maybe I'll be wrong. Perhaps we will find something nearby, and that would be absolutely fascinating. And I think it would be a real shame if we missed that opportunity just because we didn't want to look. We wanted to do other things. The other thing that I would say is that this sort of area of science is very inspirational. I was personally, I was very lucky. I grew up during the Apollo era, and was massively inspired by the Apollo program, and I'm sure I became a scientist because of that. If we found life on another world, that would have a similar inspiring effect and help to produce the next generation of scientists. So if you want a practical reason for it, that would be the practical reason. But ultimately, I think we're just curious. We're an inquisitive species, and I think it would be a real shame if we lost that. So, in my view, we keep looking. In my view, I think we'll be looking for a long time before we find anything.
Stephen in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Stephen.
Hi. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I was wondering what you think about exoplanets or moons like Europa or Titan. Some scientists think that there could be, a different form of life in those environments. But, do you think they're not stable enough to sustain such sort of...
Yeah, that's a very, very good question indeed. There are several satellites in the solar system. Europa, which is one of the largest satellites of Jupiter, for example, but there are several others, which have immense oceans on them. Their surfaces are ice, and perhaps 100 kilometer thick layer of ice at the top. But beneath that, they're warm enough for that ice to melt. Satellites like Europa perhaps have oceans that are even larger than the Earth's oceans in terms of total volume. So these are quite promising places to look for life, and lots of people are very interested in that possibility. We should definitely go and have a look, and if we find it, that would be very interesting. There would be several possibilities if we did find it. First of all, it could be transplanted Earth-like, as I said, for Mars earlier, in which case it will be fascinating that it's managed to get that far out in the solar system and to colonize out there and so on. What would be even more interesting would be if it turned out to be a completely alien kind of biochemistry that was clearly not related to Earth life, because that would then indicate a separate origin for life. In other words, my arguments from earlier in the conversation about perhaps life is not an easy thing to do, that would disprove that argument. It would actually show that life was an easy thing to do. So that's a very good example of something that we need to go out and look for. And with a bit of luck, it will actually show that on that point, at least, I'm wrong. Now, having said that, I think the chances of a complex biosphere in those places is rather small. It just hasn't got the same level of complex environment that we see on the surface of the Earth. It'd be a very, very different sort of environment, and obviously we need to guess at what that environment might be like. We really don't know. But, I guess my ultimate argument would be that we need to go and look and see. In terms of stability, actually, it's likely to be quite a stable environment, interestingly enough, because it's protected beneath that 100 kilometers of ice. So, those are the places we need to go and look.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Stephen, for the call. Talk more about our moon, the moon's orbit and size, and what that has to do with Earth's ability to sustain life.
Yeah, that's going back to the issue of axial stability for the Earth. The Earth's axis is just tilted by 23 degrees, and that gives us the seasons. And that doesn't change much. Over a few tens of thousands of years, it fluctuates by a degree or so. But it's a very small change in the strength of the seasons. Even that change is enough to make ice ages come and go. So, if you can imagine the sorts of changes you would get if it was wobbling not by 1 or 2 degrees, but by 50 degrees, perhaps you begin to get an idea of how dramatic that would be in climatic terms. The thing that really interests me about this, though, is having said that we're very close to having a moon that could cause that problem. As I said, if the moon had just been very slightly bigger, 1 or 2% larger, that would be enough for us to have an unstable axis today. The fact that we're so close to instability, I think, is very interesting and suggestive. So one of the things that I look at in the book is the possibility that there's actually something that's very good about having a large moon, something else, because our moon is almost too large. So why are we so close to that upper limit is the thing that interests me. Now, the suggestion I've made, and it is very much a speculation, is that only by having a large moon can we have a stable axis and a slow spin. Now, the Earth could have a stable axis without a moon, provided it was spinning fast enough. But if you want to have that combination of spinning slowly and stability, you need to have a large moon. But as I said, not too large, because the large moon itself causes problems if it gets too big. So I sort of see the Earth as being in a sweet spot where somewhere between having a moon that's too small and therefore in order to be stable we'd have to be spinning rapidly, and having a moon that's too large, which would cause instability anyway. Now, the reasons why a rapid spin might be a bad thing is that it tends to make the poles cold. This is down to something called the Coriolis force, the way that winds are deflected as they move from the equator, so which causes a sort of spiral weather patterns that we see on the Earth. If the Earth is spinning more rapidly, that process will be much more powerful. And what this does is it stops heat getting from the equator to the poles. So a rapidly spinning planet has very cold poles. And possibly when the Earth was young, if we'd had those slightly colder poles, that would have been enough for carbon dioxide to start to condense from the atmosphere. And that would have been a runaway cooling effect, something very similar to what happened on Mars, in fact, something which the Earth would not have recovered. But as I say, that is all very speculative. All I can say is there's something very strange about the size of our moon. It seems to be spot on. Which is suggestive, but I'm not quite sure exactly what that's telling us yet.
The Kepler mission is looking for habitable planets. What characteristics is it looking for? What traits in a planet make it more likely to sustain life?
Yeah. It's not really true to say it's looking for habitable planets. It's looking for possibly looking for planets in the habitable zone. Now, that may seem like a rather extreme. Trying to be very precise, but there is a difference. Just because a planet's in the habitable zone, now a habitable zone is that area where it could have liquid water on its surface, so it's not too far away, so it's frozen, and not too close, so that the water is all evaporated. So it's just the right distance from its star. Now, just because a planet is the right distance from its star doesn't mean to say that it does have liquid water. I mean, for a start, it needs to have some water, and it's not at all clear that rocky planets necessarily have any water at all. That's something that's a bit mysterious about the Earth, is how it got all its water. But even if you've got the water there, there are other things that affect the climate, in particular the composition of the atmosphere and how reflective the planet is. So all of those things mean that even if a planet's in the habitable zone, we can't be sure that it's got liquid water on it. And even if it's got liquid water on it, that doesn't mean to say it's necessarily got life, because, as I said much earlier on, we don't know how hard it is for life to start. It's quite possible to imagine a planet that's potentially habitable, because it's got liquid water and it's in the habitable zone, but life just doesn't develop there for whatever reason. It just never arises. Mm. So it's not really, Kepler is not really looking for habitation. It's just looking for possible places to look further. And, having said that, it's a fantastic mission. It's produced some stupendous results. Almost every week we seem to see something new and amazing come out of it. But it's early days yet. We've only been looking at exoplanets for 20 years. It's a very new science. So it could be decades or even centuries before we really start to have a very good idea of what those planets are really like.
We only have a minute left. How much longer will Earth be able to sustain life? There's one for a minute.
Right. Well, the good news is it's probably hundreds of millions of years, but not much longer than that. I think the upper limit that most people will come up to is about a billion years, and that's back to what I said earlier about the fact that the sun is getting warmer, steadily warmer through time. Within about a billion years, the amount of heat that we get from the sun is so much that even if we had no greenhouse gases at all in the atmosphere, the planet would overheat. In other words, we'd have no liquid water again. So, we've maybe got a billion years at the most.
Thank you so much for being with us. David Waltham is an astrobiologist and a geophysicist in the Department of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway College at the University of London. He is also author of Lucky Planet, Why Earth is Exceptional and What That Means for Life in the Universe. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, I hope you are with us. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for On Your Money. Information and advice on your money from financial planner Kevin McKinley. Tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.